Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. So just make your time conversions across the United States and across all the time zones, frankly, the world time zones. Another Fork in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain injured person, or for anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. As I always say, brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, at any time, and anywhere. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States living with some form of brain injury. But you know what? Most folks do not even know about brain injury. And I know I used to be one of them, and not until it came to live on my doorstep. And now I know all too much, I'm afraid. On Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. On the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury through medical professionals and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neural fatigue, anger, or any other various symptoms of brain injury. In tonight's topic, we're going to be delving into recovery after brain injury and rehabilitation and what that takes, what it involves. And we'll talk a lot more about that now, but you have to remember that everybody's rehabilitation, everybody's recovery is going to be different. So you take what you get from the show and leave the rest. Whatever's good for you. So a little bit about me. For those of you who are new to my show, here's just a teeny tiny snippet. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005, which seems like ages ago, and I guess it actually is because it's now more than 18 years, when my husband David had a brain injury. And you can learn more about that on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And, of course, this is the part of the show that I'm always reminded to say to you, have a pencil and paper nearby so you can jot down URLs. Because I often throw out a URL, a website address, to let you know about some information that you can check on after the show. And survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com is my blog, and it has tons of information for brain injury survivors and caregivers. And frankly, it's for anybody who wants to learn more about brain injury. On that site, there is there are lots and lots of interviews from survivors and from caregivers who talk about their journey on their brain injury path. So, you know, check it out after the show. Check it out and see. Just go to Survivors Speak Out or Caregivers Speak Out, and it's all on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. All one word, all lowercase. I shared David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show starting in August of 2014. And the last of which it was in November of 2014 featured a discussion with David himself. So I also interviewed David on my April 19, 2020 show. If you all remember, that's when COVID was rampant in our world. And I wanted his perspective on his brain injury after, at that time, it was 15 years old. But I really wanted to get his perspective on COVID-19 pandemic, because David is a retired professor of microbiology. And so he had a lot of insight into the scientific parts of that and doing a lot of research with others. Scientists' work. So those are things that you can find also on my site. And you can find my archive shows on my blog. And I think there are like 160 of them or more, probably more. And just click on on-air show menu. You have to get the show menu tab, because there's an on-the-air on there too. But get the on-the-air show menu, because that tab will get you to about 160 or more shows from caregivers, survivors, authors, therapists, doctors, medical people, all kinds of things, all kinds. And if you want to learn more about David there, just type in his last name, Figurski. Or, for that matter, type in anything in the search box and see if it comes up, because there are a lot of things that you might find there. Okay. Let's see, I just almost deleted my notes. That's not good. So anyhow, you can also read our complete story in my book, which is called Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. And that was published by Right Life Publishing, and it was released in November of 2018. So you can find Prisoners, as I like to call it, as a print book, an ebook, and as an audiobook. And I'm actually the reader for the audiobook too. And you can find them at all your local book haunts or your local library. And if they're not there, ask for it. They can order it for you. And when you read it, please, 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 please write a review on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, on Goodreads, because a review is a book's best friend. And you know what? It helps to let others know about a good read. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com, to learn more about me. And tonight, I hope that you're going to find my show fun and informative. Informative is the key word here. Fun comes along with it, but we want you to learn something from tonight's show. And I hope that you'll visit the shows of the other hosts on the Brain Injury Radio Network. There are shows every night between 7 and 10 p.m. Pacific time. And on the weekends, you can tune in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time to listen to your favorite shows too. Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States. In every state you can find it. And it's also in 36 different countries. So, we have a pretty wide audience, and I hope that you are one of them. And I guess if you're listening to me now, you are. So thank you for joining us. So now sit back, relax, and enjoy our show. Let me pull up my other notes so I can know what I'm going to say here with you. And like I said, we're going to be talking about recovery and rehabilitation after brain injury. And having a brain injury is just the beginning. It's the beginning of a very long journey. A journey of recovery and rehabilitation is a very, very long road of healing. There is no one-way straight road. It's a winding path with many obstacles in the way. And it's the survivor's job and that of his or her caregivers to conquer the many stumbling blocks along the way. And it's not easy. Many don't know that brain injury is all too common. They don't know that it can happen in an instant. And frankly, I was one of those people that didn't know. I never gave a second thought to brain injury before my whole life was surrounded by the effects of it when my husband had a TBI, a traumatic brain injury, in 2005. A car accident, a fall from a ladder, a bonk on the head by a treasured sculpture. Yes, that's happened to a friend of mine too. Domestic violence, rape and assault, a a slip on black ice or a simple misstep causing a face plant, ouch, can cause a brain injury in an instant. Before you can even register the thought, you've already got a brain injury. You hit, you fall, you realize you're falling, you hit your head, you hit it hard, and you've got a brain injury. And you don't know that yet. You haven't even registered that thought, but you will. You will soon enough, and that's, and it's too bad. But, and the list goes on and on and on of ways to get brain injury. Just one extra chin-up, just one, 15 instead of 12, changed my life forever when it changed David's. That 13th chin-up threw our lives into turmoil. And basically what I will give you just a little history on that, just because if you're new to the show, you don't know how I even became a caregiver. But David did 12 chin-ups every morning along with his Tai Chi regime that he devised. So he would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. He would do his exercises, get a shower, get dressed, and drive off to Columbia University in New York City, which used to be like about a half an hour commute. Well, once the towers went down, that commute turned into an hour to an hour and a half. So David's early rising, the 4 o'clock rising, was for him to be able to get to his laboratory by 6 before the traffic all started. So that all kind of happened. But no matter what, he still would have been doing his exercises and still getting to his lab at a regular time. But that 13th chin-up, that particular day, why he did it, he doesn't know. Well, I kind of do. David always likes to surpass his last accomplishment. If he's done 2 sit-ups, he'll want to do 3. If he's done 3, he'll want to do 4. If he's done 12 chin-ups, he's going to want to do 13. It's almost like that book, if you give a mouse a cookie, he'll ask for a glass of milk. Well, if David does 12 chin-ups, he's going to want to do 13. He's going to want to surpass his last goal. That's just David. It just is. So, but that's what threw our lives into turmoil. That's when I learned about brain injury. But it took me a long time to actually figure it all out. And I haven't figured it all out yet, even after 18 years. But it's a learning process, and I keep going. But I did learn that with a brain injury, you must plan on a long road back. Often, after a traumatic event, a survivor will remain in a coma for an undetermined amount of time. While in a coma, the survivor is unresponsive. David went through that period. Sometimes the survivor remains in a vegetative state. That means it's like the person is still in a coma. They may have regular sleep cycles, and they may be responsive to some stimuli, but they're never really conscious. And once a doctor says you're in a vegetative state, it's kind of doom and gloom kind. But I still say don't give up hope. But a vegetative state probably means the doctor is not really hopeful at that point. But I say never give up. Never give up. You don't know what's going to happen because brain injury is so unreliable. You just don't know what can happen and how much healing can how much healing can happen after you've been involved in it. A minimally conscious state sees the survivor responding to some stimuli, responding maybe to his surroundings, and showing some emotion. And each brain injury, as I say, every show is unique. Each brain heals differently. And there is no pattern for when a survivor will wake up. Unlike a broken arm, we know that if you break your arm, the doctor's going to put you in a cast. You're going to have to be uncomfortable and be in that cast and be inconvenienced for about 5 to 6 weeks as you are unable to move that limb of your body that's in the arm or the leg or whatever. You're going to be uncomfortable, but you do know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. In about 5 or 6 weeks, the doctor's going to cut that cast off. He's going to check out your arm, and he's going to say, you're good to go. So slowly, but you're good to go. And eventually your arm will be back to pretty much its normal state. That's not the case with brain injury. There is no pattern for them for brain injury. There's no pattern for when a survivor will wake up. There's no pattern for when a survivor will recover or how much recovery he or she will have. But when the survivor does wake up or becomes conscious of the world, then he or she is often disoriented, confused, scared, and frankly, the person does not know or understand what has happened to him or her. When David woke up, he thought that he was in a hospital for race car drivers because he thought he probably had an accident on the racetrack because he was a racer. So he had no clue. He had no idea what had caused his injury, why he was in the hospital, even where he was at some point. So it's a very confusing time, and it can make the survivor angry. So the number of problems that accompany brain injury is just countless. There's so many, and again, so differing from each person. The survivor may experience confusion or restlessness or agitation. He or she may become frustrated and respond aggressively. And although these are all seriously uncomfortable feelings, they seem to be expected in the recovery process. So I think that's important to know that even though your survivor or you as a survivor didn't experience all of these things, some of them you may be shaking your head and saying, yeah, oh, man, I was so angry and I was so restless when I first woke up and didn't know what was going on. You might be able to recognize some of these feelings, and there are so many, and probably you could tell me more that I haven't even mentioned here. But as the days, the months, the years pass, one can hope for improvement. The amount of recovery is determined by how serious the brain injury is. And doctors usually set a specific time that they expect recovery to take place in. And I was told that my husband's window was 6 months. That's the time 18 years ago that doctors were saying that if you didn't, the progress that you made in 6 months was probably going to be the limit of progress that you made. Well, they have readjusted those guesses, I guess, those approximations, because many doctors will say it's much longer now. It can be a year, 2 years. But frankly, I don't ever think you should put a time limit on recovery. Recovery in progress can continue on forever, actually. It just depends. So for that time frame was extended year and year after David continued to make progress. It took him many, many years before he was able to walk or talk. You know, well, he was talking, but his speech improved. Everything. So, I mean, it takes time, and you have to be patient. That's the only thing I could say, because it's not going to – being impatient and being unhappy and being discontent is not going to make it go any faster for you. So David, like I said before, is more than 18 years out now, and though progress is slow, think snail's pace, because that's what it feels like, we're happy for any forward movement at all. David actually came home from the hospital resembling a rag doll. That's like Raggedy Andy. Yeah, he can sometimes walk independently in the house, albeit quite robotic-like. But, hey, we're not complaining. It's something. But mostly now we're talking years later, because it took him years to get to the stage of being able to walk independently in the house. But then he's now relying on his rollator to get around the house. And with his serious balance issues that stem from the damage to the cerebellum, it's safer. And as you can figure out, 18 years has made him a few years older than he was when he actually had this brain injury when he was in the prime of his life. So we're also dealing with the age issues and things that happen as people grow older. Many people, as they grow older, don't have as much balance. Their balance becomes compromised. So having a brain injury with the damage to the cerebellum, which is the area that controls your balance, and then add on that 18 years, getting into the senior years, yeah, it becomes a little more dangerous, and so we're not taking any chances, no unneeded chances, because any fall can cause a serious setback, and we're not so in favor of that. Recovery usually starts for many in a rehabilitation hospital. with the survivor participating in hours of therapies, including physical therapy, occupational, speech, recreational therapies, and activities of daily living, ADL, they call them. And I was like, what is an ADL? ADL, activities of daily living, means brushing your teeth, washing your face, taking a shower, going to the bathroom, buttoning your shirt, anything like that. Things that you have to do just to get through your life throughout a day, activities of daily living. And a survivor must be able to engage in 3 hours of these strenuous therapies to be admitted to an acute center. An acute center is a more intense recovery center. And they, if a person is not able to sustain 3 hours of therapies, then he or she is not eligible to go into that subacute facility, the acute facility. And there is another, I talk about that on one of my shows. So probably if you look up therapies, you'll find a show on acute therapy. And it's very something I had to learn all about. I had no idea. But once I learned about it, I wanted David in an acute center because I knew he would get the best therapy, the best care, and the best chance in life in trying to regain it. So if you're not able to sustain 3 hours of therapy, then you'll be placed in a subacute facility, which offers less time devoted to recovery and more time just nursing care. So those are the kinds of things. And some people are eligible for acute because of their stamina or the way their injury has hurt them, but they are able to fight it. Other people, if you took David and had a brain injury at 85, yeah, he's probably not going to be able to get that acute facility because he probably wouldn't be able to sustain 3 hours of intense therapies. So keep that in mind if you're thinking about therapies and if you have somebody that might end up in a position such as that. So therapies don't stop when the survivor is released from rehabilitation hospital. He or she may go to a local facility as an outpatient or maybe they'll have in-home therapy that may be provided for them. But basically, it all depends on what your insurance provides. And if you want to talk about insurance, go to another chat that we talk about insurance. That's another whole topic. The long road of therapy, recovery, and rehabilitation often goes on for a very, very long time. For many survivors, it may be their entire lifetime. They say the recovery and rehabilitation process for brain injury is not a sprint, but it's a marathon. And David and I can truly attest to that. So on this note, I want to introduce my panelists. I'm very fortunate to have two panelists that return repeatedly, which I'm so grateful for because I love their input. Deb Brandon is a brain injury survivor, and she's the author of her book, But My Brain Had Other Ideas, a memoir of recovery from brain injury. Deb is, that's one of her books. She has another book out about weaving and fabric, and Deb's laughing because I'm like, but we're going to focus on her brain injury book. So Deb is a recent retired professor of mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And that's, Pittsburgh are my old stomping grounds. I was born right outside of Pittsburgh. And I went to college there. I went back there after I lived in Erie, Pennsylvania, but I went back to college in Pittsburgh. So I have a very strong affinity to Pittsburgh. So you can read about Deb on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Again, in that search box, type her name, Deb Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N. A Survivor's Speak Out interview will pop up, and so will many shows of Another Fork in the Road on which Deb has appeared. And you can learn more about Deb at her website. This is really hard, folks. Write it down, debbrandon.com. Okay, so it wasn't that hard. debbrandon.com/. So, or just Google her. Check them out, but not now. Don't do it now. After the show, please. And also, I should let you know that Deb and I are co-authoring a book together, and we're more than halfway through our revisions of Conversations. That's the title we've chosen. You Are Not Alone. is the subtitle that we have not chosen, but we're working on it. We can wait. We can't wait for you to read it. So, yeah. And basically, Conversations is another book about brain injury. Deb delves into her area as a survivor. I delve into the topics as a caregiver. So, you know, we talk about recovery and rehabilitation. We talk about neural fatigue. We talk about stress. We talk about suicide. We talk about everything in that book. So I hope it's going to be really an eye-opener. And it shall be coming to a bookshelf near you in some future. So Megan Beaudry is my other panelist, and Megan developed lupus in 2009, which caused a brain inflammation. And she has become a patient advocate for lupus. And you can learn more about lupus at lupus.net. Megan began writing as part of her rehabilitation from a brain trauma in 2014, and she simply never stopped. Her work has been published in Hippocampus, Ravishly, Folks at PillPack, Al Jazeera, and The Huffington Post. When Megan's not writing, she can be found cuddling with her rescue dogs, and I know that one is in the room with her right now. She likes to drink bubble tea, and she teaches students ages 3 to 94 how to play the violin. So you can read about Megan on my blog, again, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, and in the search box type her name, M-E-G-H-A-N, Beaudry, B-E-A-U-D-R-Y. And a Survivor Speak Out will pop up, and so will a show. Well, actually, so will lots of, oh, well, no, I'm going to say this, a show from March 21st in 2021 in which Megan appeared. And that is the show that is all about Megan. So since then, Megan has been on my panel of Another Fork in the Road many times. So check her out, and you can follow Megan on Twitter at the @ Megan Beaudry 1. That's it, Megan Beaudry 1. I always have in my notes.com, but it's not. Okay, so taking that out, I won't say that again. So tonight we have varied opinions on the topic of recovery and rehabilitation after brain injury. But remember, none of us is in the medical profession, and we only offer suggestions of things that have worked for us. So on that note, Megan and Deb, are you ready to jump in?
Yep, excited to be here.
Okay, great. Thanks, Megan. And I know Deb's right behind her. So, Megan, as a survivor with brain injury, can you tell us a little bit about your injuries and how you got your brain injury? So people have a little bit of background on where you're coming from here.
Well, there's two types of brain injuries. There's an acquired brain injury, and then there's a traumatic brain injury. So an acquired brain injury is what I had, and that means that it's the result of something medical happening in your body and not, you know, an outside force hitting you in the head. Essentially what happened is I was very sick with lupus, and lupus is an autoimmune disease. So that means that my immune system often attacks healthy tissue in my body. And in my case, my immune system decided to attack my brain. I guess it figured I wasn't using it. But so it attacked my brain.
That's not the case.
No, I actually really needed it. And I started experiencing really extreme fatigue. So, you know, I'd sleep 10 hours a night and I wake up and I was still exhausted. And then I had really bad brain fog. So it was just this kind of mental fuzziness in my head to the point where, you know, I was so kind of out of it that I couldn't even make instant oatmeal in the morning. And any word over 3 syllables I had trouble pronouncing, and then I would just lose track of where I was in the middle of sentences. And once I realized I had a problem, I was 22 years old and I was in grad school, I started going to doctors, and it was difficult to get diagnosed because it was such a rare manifestation of lupus. Usually with lupus, there's a lot of symptoms like a rash on the face, joint pain. Fatigue was definitely one of them, but I didn't have a lot of the main symptoms. And so I had some trouble getting diagnosed and then treated for the brain inflammation.
Wow, that's scary. You know, when you've got so many things going on, yeah, that you don't know and they can't figure it out because you're not following the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Hmm. Hey, and Deb, can you tell us, can you fill in the audience about how you came to live with brain injury?
Yeah, I have just a malformed thin-walled blood vessels in my brain, and two of them bled. And when it reached the point where my life would turn completely upside down, you know, I had balance problems, hearing problems, cognitive issues, and seizures. And the thing is, with these clusters, the only known treatment to prevent future bleeds is to remove them surgically. So I underwent 3 brain surgeries. And since then, as Donna said, it takes a long time to recover. And really, if it's a severe brain injury, you never fully recover. So that's where I am now.
And that's true. I think, you know, when David was given his parable, he was given, I said, 6 months. And they said, within that time, he'll probably reach 95%. And I thought, oh, geez, that's not good. Well, number one, 6 months was not correct, and 95% is not even close. Right. Dave and I talk about it. We think maybe he's gotten to about 80%, but I don't know. Maybe we would readjust. I don't even know right now. But definitely I would love to have 95% now. I'm thinking that would have been really good. But, I think because, well, I don't know, it's where his brain injury happened, you know, and that's what determines what kind of injury you're going to have and what kind of recovery you're going to have and how much damage was done in that area. And so that's why, the brain is such an unknown organ, probably the most important organ you have in your body, but it's the least known, I think. And so it's really difficult to just, prediction. And I think at the time, 18 years ago, a lot of people didn't even know much about brain injury. They'd known about concussion, but they didn't really, doctors, I don't think even knew that much about brain injury at that point. And I don't think the brain was really taught that comprehensively in college classes, even to the doctors and to the medical schools. So I think it is not. I think they probably have now, but it wasn't until I'm guessing. I'm going to take a guess, and I should know this because I have stated it when I've done the research on it. But I'm thinking around 2010 or something 12, when the troops were coming back from the wars, brain injury was getting noticed because they were coming back with IED explosion injuries. So when the IEDs go off, the explosive devices, they would cause such a bang that it reverberated in the brain, shook the brain. So they started to, study that because too many people were coming back and they're saying, what's going on? And then I think following that, shortly after that, or right at that same time, the NFL was coming up with all kinds of brain injury notifications of people that had brain injury from football. Well, it makes sense. And if you really think about it, I know when I was a little girl, my father used to watch the Friday night fight. Every Friday night at 10 o'clock, I still remember that, he would turn on the fight, the boxing, and watch these men go into a small ring the size of probably the room I'm in right now, and beat on each other's heads. To me, that is incredibly unsmart. And these people had to be having brain injuries left and right, because of that. You're getting your head beaten in. Well, that it didn't seem to impact anybody back then. nobody talked about it. Nobody really seemed to know anything about it. So anyhow, those are the kinds of things that, you know, are coming up now. We're starting to learn about it. And we're talking now 10, 15 years later that we do know a lot more about brain injury, and there's a lot of notice being taken, and that's a good thing. Megan, can you talk about how you face and tackle your daily living? What kind of therapy do you find useful, and how does your rehabilitation affect those who are close to you? And I'm throwing a lot of questions at you. But do you have any tricks that you could share that have helped you? So first thing is, how do you tackle daily living? What kind of things did you find useful, or did your family help you, and do you have any tricks?
I think the thing that I found most useful was just taking care of my body. Because I think before brain inflammation, I had thought of them almost as two separate entities, you know, like my brain and my kind of physical well-being. And it really took getting diagnosed with lupus to teach me that everything is very connected. So for me, if I don't get enough sleep, I do really struggle to concentrate. And for me, enough sleep is unfortunately 10 or 11 hours. You know, I still have to sleep a lot every night to kind of be functional. So rather than kind of work myself really hard trying to challenge myself cognitively to regain some of these skills, I found what's almost more useful is making sure that I stay in good health. And for me, it's almost like a part-time job. I have to make sure that I go to bed at a certain time. I have to make sure that I don't wake up before a certain time. And it's kind of to the point where everybody in my life knows, oh, she doesn't do mornings. Don't call her before 11 because I have to sleep really late. And throughout the day, I have to make sure I eat correctly, because if I don't, I do kind of get that fatigue and I get really fuzzy headed and it's hard to concentrate. I have to exercise a few times a week. And I have to make sure that throughout the day, I'm constantly checking in with my energy level. You know, do I need to sit down and rest? Do I need to maybe have a little bit of coffee to kind of like help me wake up in the morning? Do I need to get up and move a little bit? So it's just kind of constant monitoring that has helped me kind of get better cognitively the most.
Interesting. You said constant monitoring. So you are actively thinking about this. It's not just going through life saying, oh, I'm tired now, I'm gonna rest. You actively think about it?
It is something I have to actively think about, because the main symptom that I have is fatigue. And if the fatigue gets out of control, it absolutely leads to brain inflammation for me. It's happened several times. And so I just have to kind of pay attention. And also with lupus fatigue, it's not like normal tiredness. It kind of feels, it follows a different pattern. So for example, if I work out too hard, I might not feel it the day after, but I'll be really sick 2 days after.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like you have to be this detective. You have to figure out, oh, what caused that? And then you kind of have to find ways to avoid it and find ways to, you know, if you have something that is very taxing, make yourself feel better.
Oh, interesting. So, Deb, I'm going to ask that same question to you. How do you face and tackle daily living? And, again, what kind of therapy do you find useful? And how does your rehabilitation affect those close to you?
Okay, well, right after my second surgery, a couple of days after it, I went into inpatient rehab, and that took between my mother and my case manager, that was a huge fight to get me in. And like you mentioned, Donna, they had to evaluate whether I'd benefit from it. So it's not just about you have to be within a certain range. You can't be so badly off to benefit from it, but you also have to be badly enough off so that you'll be able to make progress. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I lost track. But
yes.
The point is,
yeah, no, you're
the point is, I mean, for instance, a week into my inpatient rehab, I felt that like I was taking up breathing room because I felt I was doing well enough that I felt that there were others who could use my bed there. Well, and then it turned out that life got a bit more interesting and ended up having a third surgery. What happened then is to get into the inpatient rehab, I needed an advocate. And after the third brain surgery, I did not have an advocate. My mom went back home. I was alone in the hospital. There was no one to root for me. So I did not end up back in inpatient rehab. I didn't end up in outpatient rehab either. Again, because I was the only one who could advocate for me, for myself, but I didn't have the wherewithal to do it.
So you probably had no idea either to do it. Who would tell me, how would you even know, you know?
Well, the things I knew, some things I knew because I learned from being in inpatient rehab, I learned about neuropsychologists. I knew about physical therapists. But that was about it. Well, I also knew about occupational therapists. But the thing is, I went to my neurologist for a follow-up, and I asked about a neuropsychologist, and I asked about a physical therapist, physiotherapy. And he gave me a name of a neuropsychologist. And when it came to any other kind of therapies, some I just didn't know about, but he said, look, it's going to be too much for you to do everything. But we can get back to that at some point. Well, I wasn't in a place to get back to that. So I didn't generate a conversation that would... So I was, you know, so basically I met with my neuropsychologist, got tested. He made some suggestions, things that was interesting. He did not suggest a regular rehab center. He said, you know, you'd be better off just playing brain games at home. But one thing he didn't take into account is when you go to some sort of rehab center, you're in some sense you're gaining a support group. So I didn't have that.
Yeah.
I did it on my own. And the thing is, after a brain injury, you feel very much alone anyway. But you know, I was alone. I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
And if you don't walk in a brain injury survivor's shoes, there's so much that you don't know about it. And, you know, as Donna said, I didn't know about it until it happened to me. As Donna said, that she didn't know about it until it happened to David. So I ended up doing the rehab on my own. I was, as Donna mentioned, I was a math professor. I didn't know if I could get back into the classroom because I couldn't remember, for instance, I couldn't remember the multiplication tables. So I had to relearn a whole bunch of stuff. And I just did it from books. First I had to learn arithmetic, and I used brain games for that. And once I got beyond that, I picked up a book on college algebra, learned that, then calculus. And then I felt ready. I reached a point where I felt that this was about 8 months after the surgeries. I felt, okay, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be able to get back into the classroom. But I was afraid to go beyond calculus. I wouldn't be able to do it.
I'd be afraid to go on beyond division, fraction.
You're
telling us that you had to relearn those twice. I was difficult enough for me to go through those classes one time.
Yeah. Well, I was lucky. I'm one of the lucky ones. There's so many people who aren't as lucky as I was. You know, it's going back to work. That's a really tough one. Many brain injury survivors can't do it because of, for various reasons, including neurofatigue.
Right.
I mean, one of the problems with fatigue is it's a double whammy. Not only do you tire easily, and you don't sleep well. That's a very mm-hmm. common combination of brain injury survivors. So, you know, like Megan was saying, it's a lot about rest. Resting is huge. Because the thing with brain injury related tiredness or neurofatigue, mm-hmm. when you're tired, you have to stop. You can't just say, oh, I'll work my way through it. No, your mind just goes, your brain just goes, uh-uh, you're done. I'm going to switch you off. And there's nothing you can do about it. You just can't operate. You have to get rest. And if you do try to push through it, I mean, I used to get horrendous headaches, and when headaches would exacerbate all the, and fatigue, it would exacerbate other deficits. So that was a hard lesson to learn. I mean, pacing myself was one of the hardest things I had to learn to do. But other than that, in terms of rehab, all I do is sit brain games on my phone. I mean, one of the things that my neuropsychologist said was that the money that goes into the gaming industry, it's much more than what rehab facilities have, you know, research to do with rehab, what they get. So a lot of the brain mm-hmm. games are better than the ones you'd get at a rehab facility. So I still play brain games because
is there an app, Deb, that you can suggest to people?
Well, there's one that's really good. It's Lumosity,
I play that one, too.
Maybe? Anyway, that's one that's good. Well, it is good. Trouble is, I reached a point there where I just got bored with it. I tend to do that.
And once I feel like for a long time, too.
Yeah. No, it's a good one. And there was another one that I came across not long ago. I forget what it is. But, even just playing just games on the computer, that's going to give you something. If you look at, there are various studies about people young people who play video games, that IQ, the measuring IQ has changed because puzzle solving, which is what you do when you're playing video, puzzle solving has become a pretty well-known skill amongst a lot of people. And that wasn't the case before video games. So the focus, and also the education system has changed. So the skills that measured IQ had to be revisited. So there's a lot more available. As I said, any kind of puzzle-solving games work, even just jigsaw puzzles. Yeah. Anything where you have to work your brain will help.
Yeah, exactly. I do jigsaw puzzles every day, every single day. I do some games on I don't even know what the names of them are. But you can go in and just find games, and they're free. They're free, and you go in and you just work your way through the levels and the different difficulties of them. I can find it here. Hang on. I have my iPad here. I don't want to touch my phone because I don't want to disconnect us. But, I can say Cookie Jam is one that I play. Candy Crush
Any
Saga.
Of the word games? Any of the word games?
Yeah.
You know, they have all crosswords, anything. There's so many different. And the thing is, they're readily available these days. That doesn't mean it's going to...
Right, Juice Jam is another.
What was the other one?
Juice Jam, Words with Friends. Those are games that I play every day. And they're fun. I play them because they're fun. But they are making your brain think. You know, you're figuring out these little things, and you progress through. And some of these games have 4,000 or more things that you can do. You know, you just keep going through. I once got up to, I think, 2,000 or 3,000, and then they dropped me back down to the bottom. I don't know why. I lost my, I don't know. It wasn't fair. But I started again and worked myself up.
Now that, I mean, I was in a situation where most of my deficits are cognitive. So work on my stamina is another one that tends to go by the wayside. Again, it's to do with fatigue and all that. So to deal with stamina and my balance, I started going for walks, and then they became hikes. And I mean, I still can't walk heel to toe because of my balance issues. Headache, there's no rehab for headaches. I mean, I was lucky that finally, last summer, they found a preventative thing from a preventative drugs for me to use, not medicine, I should say, rather than drugs. That stopped the headaches, and once the headaches stopped, I could finally exercise regularly because I just couldn't if I had daily headaches. So you know, you do what you can, but it's not easy. And as Donna said, it's a long road. But if I compare how I am now to how I was 10 years ago, there's absolutely no comparison. Or even 5 years ago, I can see the difference because the brain continues to heal. You know, you get the doctors. I have a friend who was told that in 6 weeks she'll be fine. Well, she wasn't.
Yeah.
And then she was told 3 months. And then, you know, and at 2 years, I remember her saying that if she'd known it would be this, she had really bad seizures. And they removed whatever was causing it. And she said if she'd known that her recovery from the surgery would be so horrible, she would never have had it. But her surgeries were getting worse, and she had to go through it. Her seizures were getting worse. So there really wasn't a choice, because seizures can cause brain damage in themselves. So.
Wow. Yeah. So I was going to just, I wanted to backtrack just a little bit on the acute and the subacute, which I kind of said a little bit about, you mentioned. And Deb, you also said like you didn't have an advocate for you on the second time after your mom went back. And folks, when you're in a situation where you have a brain injury, you're compromised a huge amount. At that point, and again, we talked about people not even knowing what brain injury is or what it entails. And so that's why one of the reasons I like to do this show, and I like to write papers about brain injury, is to alert people. So at least you have you've got something in your back pocket that you'll say, oh yeah, I remember somebody said that long time ago, and maybe that's what's happening now. Because, we just don't know enough about it. And if you do have some tools, then you might be able to get through it a little easier. It's not going to erase all the problems, but you might be able to understand a little bit more. Now, a brain injury survivor, as David was, would have been not able in the least bit to advocate for himself. He would have been at the mercy of the doctors, the nurses, the social worker, et cetera. And had he been at the mercy of the social worker by himself, he would not have gotten the care that he needed. I had to fight for him to get the services that I felt he needed. And it was the social worker who alerted me to what acute nursing care is. And what subacute nursing care is. It was hard for me to understand it, wrap my head around it in the beginning, but I think the most easy way to think about it is your granny is probably in a nursing home. That would be a subacute home. Somebody is taking care of her, making sure she gets her meds, making sure she eats her food. The other situation is an acute situation. It looks often much like that nursing home that Granny's in. But in this case, the patient, in order for the patient to be in that facility, they have to be able enough to do 3 hours of physical work every day, whether it be physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, each which lasts about a 50-minute session. They charge you $100, you know, for an hour. You get, they call it an hour session, but there's always like a few minutes between before so the therapist can get ready for the next patient. So you have to be able to do that. Now, for physical therapy, David, who was in a bed the whole time, could not get out of bed, walk around, do anything on his own. He had to be removed from the bed, put into a wheelchair, driven down to the gym, put onto a table where he started to play with balloons, batting balloons back and forth with the therapist. That was a lot of energy, pushing his hand out and trying to catch that balloon. It was not only physical energy, it was also cognitive energy he was using because he had to coordinate everything. I mean, it sounds silly. It sounds so simple. I mean, kids play with balloons and they have fun with them. But here you've got a grown man, a professor, batting balloons around. I just stand in the doorway and watch with, you know, brushing tears out of my eyes sometimes, but also happy and laughing. I mean, it was a mixture of things because I had to see this man being reduced to this state, but also I watched him do it with so much positivity. And he just did whatever he needed to do to help to get himself better. That maybe Granny in a subacute thing is not going to be able to do. You know, she's not going to have the stamina to sit on the table, even just sit on the table for that long could be too much, you know, but to bat balloons around or to do push-ups or sit-ups on the mat or walking between the bars, whatever it is that you as a survivor or your person has to do, you know. So it's very, very, very difficult. But I think for me, I got the idea. I learned from the social worker that the acute situation was going to be much more useful to David. Now, Deb said, too, you have to be able to get into it. Yeah, he had to test into it. It's like getting into that private high school you want to go to. You just don't sign up and say, I'm going. No, he had to be evaluated. He had to take the test. And that meant that a doctor came over from wherever, a doctor who was qualified to test him and to allow him to go into subacute, had to come and check his body out. And she was tapping on his leg. She was tapping on his knee. And I was seeing nothing, tapping on his arm and elbow. And I was seeing nothing. And I heard her going, ooh, ah, ooh. And I'm thinking, oh, no, you know. But when I went to her and said to her, I said, what are you seeing? Why are you ooing? What are you ooing? She goes, oh, there's a lot of action in there. And I'm like, oh, my God, thank you. So she was testing the inner tendons, the inner muscles, whatever is inside his leg. I don't know what's inside every one of our legs. But she was testing to see if he would have the stamina or if he had the ability to do what he needed to do while in an acute facility. And I was so grateful. So, so grateful. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew he had to get into a situation like that, or I didn't feel like he was going to progress very much at all. I thought he was just going to be put into bed, given his medication, and kind of forgotten. So that's the difference between acute and subacute, and you definitely want to be in an acute situation if you can. Interestingly enough, this is in my book. David's patient in the next bed, his roommate in the next bed, was also in the subacute facility. But to the day, His parents would allow him not to go to therapy. He was in danger of being removed from the situation, because if you can't do the 3 hours, the insurance is not going to keep you in. You know, and I'm thinking, get him out of bed. Get him to do what you need him to do, because he's not going to get better. And he was a young man. He was like, I think he was only in his 30s and he had a couple of children. And I was like, get that boy out of bed and make him work. You know, David, who was 30 years older than he was doing a better job at it. So anyhow, I also mentioned keeping a positive attitude, which David did. And I think that is absolutely critical during recovery. At least it was for David and me, especially in the beginning of the process. But even still now, I think that positive attitude really gets us through a lot of days that might be a little more taxing or trying. And in my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which I think I mentioned it. I don't know. You can get it anywhere. Ask for it at the bookstores. Ask for it at your library. But I stress the importance of positivity. And when David emerged from his coma, he was confused and he was frightened, just as I mentioned earlier that most likely people would be. He couldn't comprehend what had happened to him at first. I mentioned that he thought he was in the hospital for race drivers. He thought the people around him were other race drivers that were hurt. You know, when he found himself unable to move, unable to talk or even eat on his own, he was intubated. So he couldn't eat, and he was not able to get up and walk out of that bed. He wasn't able to do anything. He was scared. You know, I was too, but he was scared. He told me much later, when he began to regain some of his abilities, that my positive attitude eased his worries and his fears. It calmed him down. He didn't worry so much about what was happening to him because he thought that I had it all under control. Oh, boy. He figured that since I was upbeat, it couldn't be as dire as he might have thought at first. So I guess I'm a good actor. But I did keep the smile on my face and the lilt in my voice because I wanted him to be fearless. I mean, not fearless. I didn't want him to be have fears and worries. I wanted him to expend that energy, any energy, on positive healing. And not on negative thoughts about healing or not healing, as the case may be. So I think I also kept my optimistic and my cheerful demeanor to bolster me up. I mean, it wasn't just for David. I think it was initially for David because I didn't want him to feel frightened. I wanted him to know that, okay, we're going to get through this kind of thing. Let's just smile and work it out. But I think, you know, like I said, it was to bolster me up because I was scared. I was really scared. My whole life was swirling down the drain, and I didn't know how to stop it. And there's no doubting that I was feeling out of control. But if I succumb to those fears, if I succumb to my fears, I know that I wouldn't have been able to be strong for David. I wouldn't have been able to carry on some of the hardest tasks. I wouldn't have been able to make the most difficult decisions I would have ever had to make. So I had to be positive. I had to plaster a smile on my face. And I did. And I still do. I did for a very long time, for years and years. You had to keep that positive attitude. You had to look at the bright side. You had to make the lemonade because the other option was not acceptable. It wasn't an option for me. So Deb and then Megan, what are your thoughts about being positive, especially during your early recovery?
It was kind of everything. I mean, I think if I hadn't had such wonderful friends around me who were so positive and outwardly really displayed a lot of confidence that I would recover, I don't know what I would have done. Yeah. I think every time I tried to learn something new, I tried to come at it from the point of, you know, not from, oh, I should be able to do this by now, but this is something new that I get to learn, and I wasn't able to do this maybe 2 weeks ago.
So just keeping that mindset, I don't know that I would have made nearly as much progress if I hadn't had that mindset.
I think you could be very right on that. What about you, Deb?
Well, again, even though I was married at the time with two kids, I really, looking back, I can't believe how little support I had. I mean, the kids were teenagers. I didn't expect it from them. But anyway, in terms of upbeat, no, I wasn't always upbeat. I went through bouts of suicide ideation, things like that. However, and you know, and it's okay to grieve, and it's normal to grieve, and it's Donna mentioned the being frustrated and angry. It's okay to have these negative emotions, but if you get stuck in that state, you're in trouble. And thankfully, I wasn't stuck in that state. I mean, yeah, I had my bouts of feeling sorry for myself and all that kind of stuff. But for the most part, my biggest, I mean, I'm lucky that I, in terms of my sense of humor, I have an easy time of finding the humor in a lot of situations. And that includes morbid humor, you know. You know, when I told my kids that I was going to have brain surgery, I wanted them to know that this might not be a magical fix, that I might sustain damage, I might die, you know, this kind of thing. And Sarah, my daughter, she was 13 at the time, she goes, "So you could come back drooling and running into trees." And then we just, the three of us, my son, my daughter, and I, we were rolling on the floor laughing. I mean, you have to, you know, it just gets, you have to be able to laugh at things. And that's what makes me through. That my friends, my family, and I, we all, I mean, before I went into the surgery, a group of friends got together. We were talking about, somebody put together a T-shirt where printed the sort of things you don't want to hear your neurosurgeon say. You know, you don't want to hear an oops from a neurosurgeon. You don't want to hear the neurosurgeon say, "Ooh, I wonder what happens when you press on this bit." So the people around me were able to help me laugh at it. And you have to. You have to be able to. If you don't have a sense of humor, if you take yourself and the situation too seriously, it can really drag you down. So you have, as Donna said, you want a positive attitude. Now, I'm not talking about the positive attitude where everything is all sweetness and light and you never complain. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's okay to complain. It's okay to be down. But you really need that positivity to keep you going. You have to stay away from toxic situations, toxic people. And you learn. You learn who works, who you're most comfortable being around. And there are days when there were certain people I did not want to be around because they just bring me down, and I did not need that.
Yeah. And that's a good learning tool, too, to find out, you know, when you know that, you know best to keep away. You know, if you just go ahead, if you ignore the fact that even I know this is going to happen and you do it, then you're not helping yourself in any way. So that's a learning tool also that people should think about. We talked about the positivity, and I want to look at the converse side of staying positive during recovery. As you said, Deb, it's hard to stay positive every single moment, you know, and it's not realistic either. But when survivors find themselves drastically changed, either physically or emotionally or psychologically, after their brain injury, it would be easy for them to slip down that slippery slope of despair. And you mentioned that you had those feelings of hopelessness and lack of control. And those can be overwhelming. And I think it's critically important to avoid those feelings at all costs. But sometimes it's not so hard. But, one, I mean, it's not so easy. Yeah, it is hard. One of the things that David and I did was to focus on encouraging remarks by his physicians. And I call them carrots. Now, in the beginning years, I'd say the first 5 years for sure, and probably more than that, David and I were visiting doctors every week or every other week. It was some. It was the ophthalmologist. It was the neurologist. It was just countless doctors going for this test or that test or whatever. So we got used to doing that, but we also looked at those visits and tried to find the positive that came out of them. So when David's neurologist, who he was an amazing man. We had such great respect for this man. But when his neurologist called him his poster boy, and I'm putting that in quotes, poster boy, I was reassured. You know, his doctor told us that he always spoke of David's survival at every medical conference that he attended. He told his audience of how, despite given only a 1 in 600 chance of living, David survived 3 brain surgeries in less than 2 weeks. And I'm proud of David's accomplishment of beating those drastic odds. Again, remember what I said early on. If David did 12 chin-ups, he was going to do 13. If he did four miles around the track, he would go for that extra 5 miles. That was David. So it was always accomplishing. And this was another accomplishment that I thought was really cool, that he survived. I mean, a chance of 1 in 600, that's crazy. But anyhow, he did it. When David's neuro-ophthalmologist offered yet another possibility of healing, David's vision, I was heartened. When it wasn't the miracle we hoped for, because he would get so excited, this doctor, neuro-ophthalmologist, he would get so excited. He says, I think this might work. And he'd stand over David with all those little gears and everything on the glass lenses and turn this and that and the other thing. And then he would say, I think this one's going to work. And David was wearing prism glasses, which are thick lenses. And because he had a double tilted and blurry vision, it was tricky. He was trying to fix 3 different problems in his eyes. So anyhow, that was tricky. But we looked at all of those things as encouraging carrots. David and I would go home from the doctor's office and say, okay, Doug, what good did we get out of this one, you know? We never got the miracle. We never got the miracle that we hoped for. But we were always eager to try the next idea, you know, and hoping that maybe that was the carrot that was going to pay us off. So I know Deb and Megan, you both struggled with your injuries. And I know, Deb, you've mentioned already about depression. So what did you do to ward it off? And you know what? This is going to have to be our last question, ward off depression. Yeah, it's going to have to be our last question, even though I've got tons more here, because, again, time is running out. So if you can.
Well, I have help with it. I have a good friend of mine help me, and I mostly help myself in the sense, you know, crawl out of denial about whatever. You crawl out of that deep, dark pit, and you go, I don't want to go there again. And eventually, I started when I got back from the hospital, because I knew this was just too much for me to handle on my own. And so I was seeing a therapist, and then I had a really, really bad bout of being suicidal. It was to the point that I didn't tell my therapist about it because I didn't want her to stop me if I needed to go, if I felt that I wanted to go there. And when I finally realized, no, this was a really bad one, I told my therapist, I think I need to go on meds. So a lot of it was to do with, well, I'd phone this friend daily, and she would, I think you need to go on meds, Deb. And I thought, well, that's horrible. What a horrible idea. but she kept at it, and I realized that she was right. So I had someone to talk to, and it's really important to communicate. This feeling alone is the worst, and that's how a lot of brain injury survivors feel. And if you can, find someone who can, you can communicate with, and this is, you know, if you can find another brain injury survivor or a support group, that's a huge, huge gift. It made a huge difference for me. I didn't join a support group, but, you know, I met a couple of brain injury survivors, and then I met some a quote-unquote support group online. Yeah, I mean, the most important thing is between exercise and talking to people, that's the best thing you can do.
Okay. I think that's really good advice, and I heard Megan say earlier that the rest for her was one of the best things that she could do to get through her days, get through everything, to make sure she could do what she needed to do in a comfortable manner. So I think we've got a lot of good advice that came out of this talk. And I know I was going to ask you, Megan, but we're going to have to get off because another host is going to be coming into the studio, and I don't want to delay their show. So I want to thank both of you very much for being a part of this this conversation today. So Deb Brandon, thank you, and Megan Beaudry for sharing so much of your thoughts and offering hope to other survivors. And, so check Deb Brandon out at debbrandon.com and follow Megan Beaudry at MeganBeaudry1 on Twitter. And, again, you can read interviews of the other TBI survivors and caregivers on my blog at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And there are so many things there. So go check it out and see what works for you, what can help you out. That's our goal. And also you can read more about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale. You can get the cast of characters and everything at donnafigurski.com. So check that out too. And check your local bookstores and libraries. On my next show, I'm going to be interviewing, let me get my calendar up, Jana Lady Hockenjoss, and it's coming, and she's going to be talking about her book. Let me get the thing. It's coming. No, it's not coming. But anyhow, her book is called He Never Ate Cake, and it's about her father who had a brain injury, and I think she was with him when it happened, and how she was affected and impacted because of his brain injury through her life. So I'm really, really looking forward to reading Jana's book, and I'll let you know lots about it next time when I meet you on Father's Day, June 16th. So I hope that everybody will come by and hang out with us again. Don't forget, Lisa Dreyer will be coming up next week on the second. She is the second and fourth Sunday of the month about her show. It's really interesting, Mess with MS. And if you loved my show, tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me. So on that note, we'll see you on June 16th. Megan Beaudry and Deborah Brandon, thank you so, so much for joining me tonight and sharing your inner thoughts about your recovery and your rehabilitation after your brain surgeries. Thank you, girl. Women, well, ladies.
Thank you.
Whatever.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Take care, and we'll see you again soon. Good night, world.